All right. I just like to say just a couple more points, and then we'll just open it up. But things that meant a lot to me, you know, we keep talking about the paradox of mystery. And what do we mean by mystery? It's a kind of one of those terms we stamp on stuff we don't know very much about. It's a mystery. A puzzle, you know, like we have detective mystery stories. Or we have mysteries from things that sort of we don't know much about. Like I was reading or listening to a book on this by a research doctor on genomes and how it just brought him to faith in God. Well, I knew what he meant by God, but I don't know what in the world he was talking about with biology. Well, man, it was way over my head. Hey, but if I put the time and effort into it, I could find out. And things like my computer's often a mystery. I have this reading program where I can put the print on the scanner, and it scans it, and then it reads it back to me. They're great. Some of its own pronunciations, one thing I found, it doesn't like abbreviations. And ran across the Book of Wisdom, and they abbreviate it, WS. Well, the first couple of times it spelled it. And, then the computer figured out what it was. It added a new book to the canon of Scripture. I now have the Book of Wisconsin. Sort of cheesy book. But I was working on this one day, and I just learned how to save the pages that were read. I didn't put another file in this and that. I don't know what I did. I jammed the whole thing up. I couldn't get anything. So I'm pushing buttons, and finally the computer says, "You have made a fatal error." Oh, sweet Jesus. To you or to me? So, that's not the mystery we're talking about. This mystery is what Martin Buber calls the I-thou relationship between, say, ourselves and others and God. Or Rudolf Otto, famous, but many years ago, came up with this book that...
The Idea of the Holy?
Yes, Idea of the Holy. And his Mysterium Tremendum et Facinans, this mystery that sets us in awe and wonder and sometimes fear, and yet is near and draws us ever closer. And he developed that now. He sees that all through the Epiphanies and throughout all different religions. It had a great influence on me. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And Rahner, this is Karl Rahner's big central theme in some of his later theology. The holy mystery, ever greater, ever nearer. You know, panentheism, far and near, how they combine it. So those are just some aspects of mystery that I thought that was helpful to me when I first ran across it. Just how do we call, what do we call God? Couple things about, we're pretty familiar with all of the scriptural images. The political images, God is king, the warrior, the defender, one who leads his people. The human things that God as the lover, one who calls us into covenant, the spouse, Sophia, and on and on. Yeah. And, you know, Jesus uses the different ones about kingdom. But some that I found helpful for me are Paul Tillich's The Ground of Being. That really says a lot to me. The ultimate concern. And to meditate on that. What does that bring me to? One I like, sometimes even far out, John Shelby Spong, the Episcopal bishop. That one lady told me, "Don't read him, he's a heretic." Oops, okay. But he had a beautiful thing on his notion of God. Ultimate life, ultimate love, ultimate being. And he goes on to spell that out. To me, that's just such a beautiful way of approaching how we speak of God. But, you know, still, those philosophical ones, You know, they're great for thought, but I don't find them terribly appealing in prayer, you know. You know, I don't say prayers to the ground of being of the ultimate mystery. I still use the personal terms. Like one little girl said, her mother asked her, why when she said her night prayers, she never prayed to God. She says, well, I like to pray to people with skin on. A person is something in our experience. So we can pray, personally I do, and things like the panentheist God, you know, everything is evolving and God is not intervening, so why do I do petitionary prayer? Well, it comes so naturally. I want to pray for those who need help, you know, because we know that concern for others goes out, and there is a power there. We don't know quite how it works, but it does. There's a concern for our country, for the world. Is it just a reminder for me to be aware? Yeah, but there's more than that, too. So I use the personal prayer all the time. It bothered me for a while. I shouldn't be praying for using petitionary prayer. God knows. Maybe God likes to hear me, make sure I know, that I'm concerned. But anyway, we can go a lot of places with that. But I don't want to take up all the time. How about you folks? Got any questions or comments? Anybody?
John, I want to comment on the idea of praying.
Yes.
For other people. I think you know, sometimes science can break down ideas of mystery and be very materialistic. Mm-hmm. But other times science can do the opposite. And there is this notion more and more of the material is equal to energy.
Yes.
This is Einstein's big breakthrough. And science has demonstrated that when we think about and think about with a compassionate heart, things like plants or shrimp, mm-hmm. Even at a distance, that they fly.
Yes.
And so, I mean, to me, that's what prayer is. It's putting energy in the field.
Beautiful.
Making like an image,
yes,
with love, but also with a certain degree of abandonment isn't quite the right word, but resignment that maybe, you know, what I think needs to happen.
Right.
Yeah, obviously, thy will, not mine.
Yes, yes. Yes.
That this seems to me is something that increases my own sense of being part of the mystery.
Wonderful. That's really good insight. And I think, too, then, for, you know, praying for people's health and things, I think that energy does go out.
Yeah.
Good.
Maureen? Well, related to that, I can't remember the book right now, but it talks about how when you do a good deed for someone else or extend a kindness, that you actually increase the serotonin in that other person and in yourself and in the community. And that's a real, that's an actual physical thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that also mysterious thing. And that always impressed me as, you know, kind of encompassing the mystery of it all.
Ah, right.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Judith? I was just thinking, Keith, about panentheism and then the prayer that we all say, Our Father who art in heaven.
Yes.
So how are you going to square that?
The image.
Speak about that.
John Shea has a beautiful commentary on the Our Father, where we're being called, you know, when he talks about heaven, to go to the other realm, the realm within. And thy kingdom come. Bring that me into that realm, bring it in here, and thy will be done. Your question says, you know, God's kingdom's okay, it's our kingdom that's a mess. We got it. But yet, that whole idea of, let's use this as metaphor. And as it developed, you know, unfortunately, the Greek tends, and this is what the Gospels are written in, the Greek tends to use their particular philosophical concepts, where they say the Aramaic, Our Father, is much richer. that it just broadens out. What's his name? The guy that's a big expert. Douglas Stoltz? Something like that. He says all those prayers in the Beatitudes, they were made to chant. They were made to sing. And he does sing it out. And you can tell when he's doing it in Aramaic, it's poetry. But to keep using that idea of the metaphor. And what's it pointing to? And there are just so many ways, like, the, you know, give us this day our daily bread. Okay, what? For most of those people, that's a real concern. They live hand to mouth from day to day. You know, for us, it can be much more metaphorical. What's the bread we need for my growth, my spirituality, for others? But anyway, you can go on with that. But good point.
Joe? I think it's that the Trinity allows it to connect it to more of the pantheism, maybe because, you know, there's our Father who art in heaven, but then there's his Son who came down to earth, and then there's his Spirit who still dwells among us.
Good.
So
good.
It doesn't have to be thought of as something
right
in the distance.
Right. And I thought, you know, when we took the Trinity theology, oh, we got all tangled up in the scholastic philosophy. What is person and nature and substance? Oh, yeah, I don't even remember. And it just missed the beauty of what you're speaking of. Like the Orthodox Church, they say, forget the theology. The Trinity is a poem. Poem of God's love going out and being so great it creates another, and that love goes out to us. And remember, Dave Rico had the icon of the three angels. There's one that had the mirror in the center of it at one time, so that we see ourselves in the Trinity, and you know how that love is to be carried out with others. But I think just the Trinity means so much more to me. Just what you were saying, Joe, rather than all the rational theology.
Yeah.
I don't know, have you ever read many of the patristic fathers? Yeah, I know we hear of Augustine, but a lot of the others no one ever reads anymore. In fact, that used to be the story of when we were in theology, and they had their main meal at noon, and then all the guys said, okay, time to go read the fathers. Well, it's a siesta time. Nothing to put you to sleep faster. But if you read them, you went, what in the world are you people trying to say? You know, you got all these images and this language pouring out, and I don't know what you're talking about. Well, you know, the late Middle Ages came along, and Thomas Aquinas discovered the Greek philosophy, and we had a framework now that we can talk in. And it was all very logical. You could spell it all out. And, like, remember Thomas's famous words at the end? Said it's all straw, all the work, you know. He looked beyond it. Wasn't the work in the end. Well, I'm carrying on here again. Let's hear somebody.
Jane had a question.
Oh, it was just a comment about the Lord's Prayer, Our Father in Heaven. Mm-hmm. I like to think that heaven is here on earth as
yeah.
well. So if you think of it that way, Our Father in Heaven is right here with us, you know. And
right. Good one.
Tom?
Just a little reflection on the word mystery. I come from a discipline that I guess could be called history. Mm-hmm. And we have a saying in this discipline, what's hit is history and what's missed is mystery.
Good.
but what, you know, this issue of missing, again, using the metaphor of vision, sometimes in the night sky, when you look up, if you look directly at a star, you don't see it, or even at the Milky Way, you don't see it as clearly or as beautifully as if you kind of look a little bit to the side and catch it with your peripheral vision. In other words, it's sometimes the case that the area in the human eye that is supposed to be the most acute is not always the most perceptive.
Mm.
And I think this also applies to the way we look at God.
That you can,
if you look at, try to assault God head on, you're not going to get nearly as far as if you look a little bit to the side and take it all in.
Right.
Use your peripheral vision or of your mind, in other words. So it's a
good point, yeah. I like that.
Sir, go ahead.
The issue that drives most people, the very bright people, away from a belief in a loving God is the existence of evil.
Yes.
What's happened in the last century, of course, is the prime example.
Oh, yes.
He addresses it very, very slightly. I'm trying to find the exact spot in here when I read the chapter, but he doesn't take it head on. He speaks of it and then and
he moves on.
And
yes.
He doesn't address it. I found that surprising.
He does more in his more lengthy book, The God We Never Knew. The Heart of Christianity is mainly a summary of his three major books. Reading the Bible Again for the First Time, and Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time, and The God We Never Knew. And so those three are the trilogy that sums up his thinking, and he gave us a summary here. But yeah, you're right, he didn't spend a lot of time on that. And it fits into the idea of the new creation story and the evolving, how we're all part of this, and part of the evolution is birth, death, life, suffering is part of it. And it's not a God intervening, you know, that zaps some people and not others, or why does he stop this war and maybe not stop the others? Like, who was it was so distraught, and why didn't God stop the fighting in Ireland? Well, because the IRA isn't listening, probably something, you know, in the other group. But seeing that God, that intervening God, is a real problem. Why does he let some of this? Why do children suffer? Why do these things happen? To me, that older intervention type God just doesn't work. And oh boy, people, you know, like even the Book of Job, you know, tries to explain suffering, why it happens, why. And at the end, he says, "Well, I know my Redeemer lives," and that's Job's solution. He says, I don't know, but I just have this feeling, you know, God is there, embracing me. Well, I think this panentheism, at least to me, shows that hey, this is all part of life. But I think a big thing, too, is to see how much suffering is caused by human neglect and evil and seeking of power. And what do we do about that? But you're right. He doesn't take much time on it, other than mentioning it's a way out of the dilemma the supernatural theism gets into. But, anything else?
Recently, there have been surveys of different Western countries. How many people believe in God?
Right.
You've read some of these or heard about them. And to me, it's very hard to understand that people don't believe in something.
Yeah.
They may not believe in the God as presented, you know, like he created the universe in 6 days.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me, as a human being, you have to believe in something. And I don't know if you... And to
right.
me, I need that belief. And it seems to me everybody should.
Right.
And they may not be answering the question. When they answer the question, do you believe in God? They're really not thinking about themselves, you know, what they really do believe. They got to believe
in something, right?
In something, yeah.
Yeah, some what brings meaning in your life. For some, hey, it's wealth, power. And even for some people who say they believe in God, but God is not the meaningful goal in their life. And, you know, remember the God is dead movement?
Yeah.
They're talking about the supernatural theistic God. And that's what Dawkins and a lot of these other people, I haven't read their books, but read some of the things that they, oh, thank you. Better put it away before I lose it. The way they're writing, that's the God they see. and the God that fills in the gaps. Well, we don't need that God anymore. Science is doing that for us. The God that's the projection of our helplessness, you know, take care of what we can't. And, no, okay, there are other ways of looking at it. But you're right. Who is it? In the Holy Longing, Rollheiser talks about that. That everybody has a spirituality. For some, it's very materialistic. He goes through, you know, various rock stars, and people have said what their goals are. Some are very self-centered, some altruistic. And he says, here, our Christian life, this is what we are called to. But you're right, everybody has something. I think even if it, you know, I used to wonder about some of the guys I'd run across in the jail that just seemed so evil and so angry and so destructive. And I wonder if that has become their goal. You know, they've been so hurt in life. Their goal is to reach out and hurt someone else. But that really, I guess that was the time I really came face to face with evil. Very few. Most of them are just poor lost souls. But once in a while, I went across somebody just scared the daylights out of me. And, you know, sometimes the negative can be a more influential experience than the positive. But for me, you know, I never had any great mystical vision of God. I think my idea awareness has just built up gradually over the years. But my experience of evil would just bash me in the nose a few times, you know. It was obvious. What else?
Ginny? Speaking, Keith, when you speak about evil, when I was in my year of silence, it was during that time Saddam Hussein was being executed.
Oh, yeah.
And he became very present to me in a very silent form of asking for prayer, and I can't explain that.
Right.
Except that I would wake up every morning, and that would be the first thing that was there.
Mm.
And so it was such an experience to me of how we're all one and we're all connected, mm-hmm. and
right.
that somehow it's all intertwined, and that our prayer for each other, we never know how it's going to come or how it's going to present itself.
Right. Good. Sort of like his time of need was reaching out, and that energy was coming to you especially.
I wanted to write to him, but I thought I might, my whole family might
end up down Guantanamo.
And then I realized it wasn't on that plane at all. I
yeah.
Write to him.
Right. Good point.
Yes, Christine. Along the same subject here, this business of evil has really been on my mind a lot. Mm-hmm. And because on one hand I get this strong impression that there is no devil, but evil is real.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do I do with that? And I remember one of our speakers, she was wonderful, an Episcopalian, she wrote many books.
Was it Beatrice Brito? Didn't she talk about it?
Not Beatrice Brito, the other one.
Cynthia
Bourgeot.
Oh, yeah.
I asked Cynthia, I said, Cynthia, more and more, I just feel there's no devil business for the birds. But I said, I know there's evil, you know. And she goes, yes, she says, evil is real, and evil has an energy to it.
Yeah.
And then I said, well, then where does it come from? And reflecting on that, this is just my own, you know, where I'm at right. this point. God created us as we are. So it must be part of His plan.
Mm-hmm.
So we were created with the capacity for evil. And maybe the part God kingdom come is for us to realize that we are throwing His bone to conquer.
Yeah.
And we can either radiate more energy towards that and give it alive, or radiate the other energy to extinguish it.
Good.
Whether through prayer or action.
Right. And you know, this has been a question down through the ages. Remember the Zoroastrians? they're about the first ones recorded, I think, that I've read that they finally decided, well, there was a God of good and a God of evil. There are two energy sources. And it comes down through history.
Did you have a question back there?
Yes, I've always had a question about ego. I feel I've seen ego. I've been to the war in Northern Ireland. I mean, is it really evil or is it mental sickness?
Evil or what?
Mental sickness.
Mental? Yeah, some of it is too, yeah. But I think that evil has, you know, the negation of what we're called to. And, you know, in the image of the Bible, no, I won't serve. I will not, you know. I'm going to be the center of things. And the seeking of power, what does that do to people? You go, oh, who was it? Just read it the other day. How the image already, Cain and Abel. There's already the evil that's there. I've got mine. How am I going to get yours? You know, that, and how that evolves. And in their mind, oh, it's such a mess. Okay, let's just drown it all out. We'll start over again. But, yeah, always a problem, isn't it? How do I deal with it in my life?
Harriet?
One of the things I really liked in this chapter was the part about the two worldviews. Uh-huh. And that, again, goes to evil. It's like, whichever side you're on, you look at the other as evil. You know, like, and I can see it so much in the election. That's obviously two world views.
Yes.
And I wonder where we're called to reconciliation in that. I mean, it seems like that is, we can't demonize the other. There's got to be a way to hear what they have to say if they have disagreed, but not to think that they're bad people. And I feel as if I'm being demonized from the other side, and so it's interesting.
It is.
I love the way you put it, though. I thought it was really well.
And that's that dualistic thinking, either or.
Yeah.
And Jesus saying, no, both and. Because the either or thing, if people hurt us or disappoint us, they're not just somebody who did something I don't like, they become an enemy. I label them. And look how, especially the dictatorships, one way to vilify people, call them names. You're not a human being, you're an idiot, you're stupid. Yeah.
That one.
No, and even in this thought, that liberal conservative gets to be either or.
Oh, yeah.
You're saying, hey, no, don't go there. See that, I've been reading more and more in that dualistic thinking. Very necessary for science. And to categorize things and divide them up and see how they differ. Not in spirituality. There, we've got to put stuff back together. Lots of good stuff going around that way of thinking.
Sharon? Ooh. Sharon?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot lately about labels that we put on people.
Ooh, yeah.
It's like we put them in a box and then write that label on it.
Sure.
It's easier to hate them when they're in a box with a label on it.
Right.
And the challenge for us as Christians is to open the box so there's space for that person. If we pray for them, they can come out of the box.
Right.
And they can be lovable.
And it takes an effort. That's
images I have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. I love that saying.
Yeah.
As a Christian, I love all mankind. It's just people I can't stand. Individual. Yeah. Put a label on them, stick them in the box. Yeah. Yeah. What else?
Yes, sir.
Earlier you mentioned Bishop Sparman.
Uh-huh.
When he came into town, I went to hear him speak. Uh-huh. Because I was interested. I came from the same area where he was bishop in Newark there all those years.
Newark, oh yeah.
He was quite a performer. Put on a great show.
Yeah, good speaker.
In the course of his sermon, he had acknowledged the existence of evil.
Mm.
He never spoke about sin, but from the context, and I tried to get up to ask, to question him on it, whether he believed it existed, but I couldn't get to the mic. But from the context, he admitted, yes, it is evil, but he seems, it seems that his position is there is no such thing as sin. And he, you know, I don't know if you got the same impression from him.
No, I didn't, but I wasn't looking for that either. I might have missed it. I'm trying to remember. It's been a while since I've read him. I wonder if sin for him has a particular connotation he doesn't want to get into, so he's going to use some other terms. I'm sorry, I just don't remember.
Ginny? Well, Keith, sin is missing the mark. It has a whole connotation than if you think it is evil. If you see sin as missing, you know, you had your target, but you missed it.
Missed it, right. Paul uses that, doesn't he? Hamartia, you know, which we translate as sin, and not the strict translation is missing the mark. So many of those. Pardon?
That is the scripture translation?
Yeah. Hamartia, the term, at least that Paul uses for sin, we translate it as sin. What it really means is missing the mark. So it's a lot of those. Did I tell you one about the scripture scholars?
No.
No, I didn't. You know, they, they're in the scriptorium up in heaven, all the old scholars all over the years, and they're writing out the book, and all of a sudden they hear this cry of anguish from the back, and they rush over. What? What? You see, it doesn't say celibate, it says celebrate. So translations are already an interpretation. Yeah. Yeah, so already you're getting in, and they're going to interpret things according to their cultural view at the time, and sometimes we transfer it over into ours and it just doesn't fit anymore. It takes a lot of work, but just the richness of looking back into what are the meaning of these things. This is where I like Forbes, you know, historical, metaphorical. That's just so rich. What else?
Don?
Going back to evil and trying to ponder it, one of the things that I've tried to do is, you know how in everything, we sort of like the Gospels teach us to come to some of these abstract ideas through nature. So, like, faith is like a mustard seed, or, you know, and so on. I've tried to look at the idea, this is going to appeal more to the people who are sort of science, you know, folks, but to look at the idea of dark matter that they're starting to talk about more and more as our telescopes can actually observe its influence. And I mean, it's incredibly frightening to think of this thing called dark matter, which is in greater proportion in our universe than light matter.
Really?
And it has this enormous power to destruct, where it seems like if all of this dark matter can go into a star and you know, disappear from this four-dimensional world we live in, perhaps to another dimension. And so it's sort of exciting right now to live at a time where in that big cyclothon or whatever it is in
Switzerland,
that they are trying at a very minute level to replicate the creation of matter. And so I just offer that as, you know, like a work in progress of trying to take that metaphor that's available to us now to understand maybe in a way that's not quite as antithetical to our value system. What dark matter is.
Right.
And so what does that mean about its interaction with light matter?
Right. Boy.
NOPA had a program on a couple of weeks ago that was pretty astounding. I agree with you.
And this, you're talking about black holes?
Yes.
And
yes.
Just everything is swooped into the black hole? Mm-hmm. I mean, when you try and relate that to God God, the universe that we've always thought about, our worldviews, it really expands one's mind.
Yeah. I could add another. I've never told everybody this, but when I hear about that, you know, and they look at it in terms of the positive nine dimensions of reality as opposed to just the four dimensions we know. To me, it's my way of understanding an afterlife. That this swooping into someplace else outside of the four dimensions, but who knows how that interacts with our four dimensions. But it leaves this in some concrete way, and yet we have no reason to believe it is truly destroyed. It's just no longer present in the in the three dimensions plus time.
Right.
So it's one way in which I can support, maybe tenuously, the idea of an afterlife.
Right. Right. It doesn't make a lot of sense when you talk about resurrection. You didn't come back to just this life, but there's that whole other dimension to it.
Mm-hmm. Of which we might be just a projection.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Wow.
That takes some study.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Jude?
I'd like to offer an example. We have to go back 800 years and look into the life of Francis. I'm one of those persons that everything I get a hold of Francis, I like to read. Francis of Assisi, of course. But, you know, he was very positive. If you pick up a lot of the things that came down from him, he wasn't a condemner of the things around him. He was very positive. And he spoke of love. He spoke of reconciliation, of compassion. And the time he lived in wasn't probably a lot different than ours. There were wars and injustices. And I think it's a real inspiration. And see how his message has gone down over the years. One of the most extraordinary persons in the history of the world, I think.
Except his own body.
Yeah.
Body recognized at the end.
That's right. Right. Yeah, somebody said that Jesus is the first one, has the most books written about him, next is Francis.
Is that right?
I read that, heard it someplace. But there sure are a lot of his books about him.
Maureen?
Well, so I have this question. We haven't really mentioned Jesus as God.
Right.
I mean, in all this talk today, maybe that's the next chapter, but as, I mean...
That's next week.
Yeah.
Well, next chapter. The image of God among us. But I think Father Tom, what was his name?
Barnhouse, David.
Yes.
Yeah,
he's going to speak on that.
Yeah.
So that's a lead-in for next week.
There you go.
We find out who Jesus is.
Yes.
The other part of reality.
Yes.
Any other questions?
Well,
we want to thank you very much, Keith.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.